Hello and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. Celebrate Arab American Heritage Month with Sahar Mustafa, who discusses her recent novel, The Beauty of Your Face. This conversation took place April 8th, 2020, and was recorded live via Zoom. We hope you enjoy entering the mind of a writer.
Welcome, welcome everyone. Welcome everyone to the first virtual author event in the Jean and John Rowe program series associated with our exhibit, My America, Immigrant and Refugee Writers Today. My name is Allison Sansoni, and I'm the program director here at the American Writers Museum. Our stories connect us through history in good times and in bad, and in difficult times, they remind us that we are not alone and never have been. And as long as we can tell stories to each other, we never will be. We're very grateful tonight to be joined by writer Sahar Mustafa, whose novel, The Beauty of Your Face, was just published yesterday. Congratulations, and thank you for being here with us.
I really appreciate it. And this feels especially meaningful. Being the first person, but then it also being Arab American Heritage Month. So it just feels like everything is falling in place, you know, despite the pandemic. So thank you for having me.
No, we appreciate you making the time. Tell us first of all, a little bit about the book and where the central story about FF came from. How did you first imagine her?
So I had written a short story about gun violence and a teacher in my short story collection. So it was a topic that, has been close to my heart and mind for years, but it wasn't until the very tragic hate crime shooting of three young Muslim Americans in South Carolina did I decide, okay, I'm going to sit with that particular event, fictionalize it, of course. And that was basically the seed. So first draft was kind of an exploratory one through the Story Studio of Chicago, wonderful organization. And it sort of helped me decide on the focus, and that being at that. Before it became this book, there were multiple Muslim characters, and I just wasn't getting close enough to their stories. So I had to sort of step away and come back to it, and Afaf sort of materialized. So the hate crime had always been there. I knew I wanted to concentrate on that, and that be sort of the framing of the book. But Afaf's story just sort of emerged, and the writing became so swift after that. And I think it, you know, the one character really allowed me to get close to the story that I wanted to tell.
Yeah. Really early on in the book, there was a passage that really struck me about, you know, religious and cultural and national identity, when Afaf's daughter comes home and is asking if she can wear a hijab. And she's saying, you know, and you write, hasn't every Muslimah asserted this collective identity to the world? There are a lot of different ideas in the book about identity and, you know, Afaf's, her brothers, her parents, mm-hmm. And the views of the school shooter whose actions bookend the narrative. What is your idea of identity, and how did you come to that understanding for yourself?
I think what I've discovered, you know, and that has sort of nurtured this writing identity, is that there's not just one story, you know, concerning identity, and that it is this amazingly multifaceted thing. And I wanted to accomplish a story that wasn't retelling sort of the single narrative of Muslims, of Arabs, of Palestinians. And so for me, you know, identity is also fluid. And I think we sort of watch Afaf in the book sort of wear and throw off maybe a few. And it isn't until, you know, midway through does she discover this Muslim identity. So it's not one that is even, you know, existent at the beginning and in her family. So, yeah, I would say that, you know, identity for me has been, you know, just this experience of fitting into places, especially here in America. I lived in Palestine for a while, and sort of, you know, moving through even phases, I guess. Yeah, it's not a single story for me. And I think Atheth probably represents that in the book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Did writing this book change how you explored your Palestinian heritage? You've dealt with it before in fiction, but how was this story different?
Yeah. So in my short story collection, I focus a lot on the lives of Palestinian Americans. This one actually brought me closer to the Muslim heritage and faith. So that was probably the most significant element that, you know, I had to spend time examining. I'm obviously not a visibly Muslim person. So that was something that was just amazing to also research and get close to. So I wanted to make sure that that telling was authentic. So I would probably say that was the most, not surprising, but interesting part of this book. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's the book also deals, you know, in a really moving way with Afef finding community in her local mosque, and then what happens when she has to challenge that sort of newfound community and go against what one of the elders in that mm-hmm. community believes to be the right thing. Yeah. And she's so grateful to have these positive and loving relationships, but she finds as an adult that those relationships are more complicated than she thought. And can you talk a little bit about the tension between belonging to a community and asserting sort of individuality in the face of it?
Yeah. So that section, and I won't spoil the plot, was important to me to reveal that, you know, the stereotypical, her finding Islam has now suddenly made everything better is not actually true. And that in the end, she's still dealing with very flawed human beings who are also trying to preserve what they think are, you know, important secrets, I suppose. And, you know, at that point, you know, as an educator, she has to make this moral choice that conflicts with a religious leader, this sort of matriarch who's become like her surrogate mother. So I wanted to make sure again that I was presenting dilemmas and characters that were very human, and that just because, you know, she comes to Islam, she was still going to have to face some hard issues. And I hope that comes across meaningfully and authentically. Again, trying to avoid the stereotypical views, you know, the single narratives of Muslims. And I actually enjoyed writing that particular chapter because here is someone who was a role model to her that she's having to challenge. And she has to make choices still. So Islam does not answer every question, you know, and she's still very much a human being trying to navigate those tough situations.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it's such a universal story too, in that, you know, in terms of a coming of age story, that realizing that just because someone is your elder doesn't mean that they're always wiser or that you have to make the same decisions yeah. they do, no matter how much they mean to you.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think she has been her experience has been sort of devoid of stable adults, you know, from the beginning. Yeah. And so here's someone who seems, you know, flawless, and, you know, she's not. And Afef has to contend with that. And again, you know, just reinforcing that even within the community, we are nuanced, you know, and I again hope that representation, you know, came across.
Yeah. Yeah. You talked in interviews and you talked a little bit just now about not writing sort of the stereotypical story of a Muslim immigrant family and, you know, not writing for the white gaze or what white audiences may have come to expect of that kind of story. What do you have a community in mind that you do write for? And, you know, how do you view your responsibility to that community?
I definitely was writing for someone like myself, Allison. And I think that's probably what I've been doing since I've been writing professionally. So it's that idea of what is the book that I want to read? Let me try to put that book into the world. And quite frankly, I have been most nervous about my Muslim Arab Palestinian community reading this. I'm really interested in their responses to it. And I received a few days ago just a beautiful response from a fellow Muslim writer. And she really just boosted my confidence because I'm thinking of my family, I'm thinking of my friends, and now seeing this book in their hands on Facebook, on Twitter, I want to make sure that, you know, I sort of have gotten it right. But what does that mean? I hope that it's one more unique story that I'm putting out and not just sort of putting something that is expected. I hope that there are, you know, surprises, but then also things that are very familiar to my community. I want them to be able to see themselves, but then also walk away with, oh yeah, that wasn't exactly my experience, but I can see that. Yeah.
Your characters in this book, they grapple with language as, you know, as immigrant parents, as immigrant children, and they move from English to Arabic and back again. How does your work in multiple languages influence your writing?
So that's a really good question. I always want to make sure that I get the Arabic as right as possible. I learned Arabic formally when I was transplanted to Palestine in the 80s. And so the idea of, you know, raising children here was actually not in the original plan for my parents. So we still actually have a house overseas, but the political climate is so volatile that we had to return after the first uprising there, the first Intifada. So I learned Arabic formally the way I would have here if I were learning Spanish. And that really changed the way I viewed myself because I had no real sense of how much language is tied to my identity and heritage and my parents and their ancestors. And I've come to appreciate how language actually preserves heritage, especially when you're living in America. And we have so many racial identities. So in the book, I wanted to make sure that I presented in a way that did not confuse readers, but I was not going to be concerned if they didn't get something immediately. And I've had to sort of experiment with that, you know, during the course of my career. In fact, I moved away from italicizing Arabic phrases when an editor of a feminist magazine I had submitted a story said, "We don't do that here because that's othering the other." And it clicked, and I thought, "Oh, yeah." So here, you know, I was still sort of influenced by that white audience, you know, or the non-Arab, non-Muslim. Yeah. And I thought, yeah, I think I need to reconsider. And it just made, I think, all of my writing after that authentic. And I really appreciated that experience.
Did you find that there were concepts that are easier in Arabic to express than in English or vice versa?
Oh, yeah. Yes. There are some things that might have taken a bit more to translate completely and some things that I just might not have included just because it felt like too much of a barrier. But I think, again, if I'm presenting Atef and these characters, I could not shy away from the language of her parents, which is Arabic first. She actually is a fluent speaker. She is actually someone who, you know, helps her mother as her older sister does. So she's had this experience just like me of having English first and then sort of adopting the Arabic.
What so much of the book is about Afaf looking for that stability and looking for that sense of home that she feels that she should have but never really had with her parents. What forms your ideas of home? What creates the idea of home for you?
For me, you know, it hasn't really been about physical place. I've come to realize now, just because, you know, I feel like I've been sort of existing between spaces. So I was born here, I was raised here, but didn't always feel like I always belonged. And when I finally lived in Palestine, I still was sometimes considered an outsider there because of, you know, my Americanness. And in some ways, yeah, that has had me think about privilege too. And being able to leave a place that is politically volatile and be able to thrive, you know, here in the States. So for me, home has taken, I think, different forms, you know, as long as I've been living. And I would say that for me, if I were to define home, it's definitely family, it's language, it's food. All these things that, again, I hope come through the book. So it is, it's definitely not a fixed thing or idea for me, mm-hmm. especially being Palestinian, I guess. Yeah. And just that, the legacy of displacement.
Yeah. I was just going to say the things mm-hmm. that you're describing are all things that you can take with you.
Yes. Yes, definitely. Yes. And, you know, for Afaf, it's so interesting, you know, and I'm glad that in some of the comments and some of the reviews that I've come across, people seem to appreciate that she's not running away from this Arab home. She is starving for it, you know, but with the dysfunction that's happening, with the major loss that she experiences, that has become sort of shattered. And through Islam, she finds another kind of home, I suppose. And it does feel like it comes full circle, I guess, especially with her father, but I won't say anymore. don't want to give away plot, but I definitely think that with Afaf, she was just so starved for belonging, but belonging to her parents, you know, belonging to a community, and it not necessarily being the white community, because she was rejected by them. She was also rejected by the Arab community when she's in high school. So she'd been floating, you know, for a number of years.
Yeah. What was it about religion that you think that made her feel so at home, that made her settle there?
You know, I don't think it was the religion first. I think what we see in the book is that it's the women, it's you know, that matriarch who embraced her without any judgment. You know, they don't look at where she's come from, the destructive behavior that she engages in, anything having to do with her family. She just is so unconditionally embraced by this wonderful circle of women. And in that sense, it feels quite feminist to me, you know, because I know people are not able to reconcile feminism with Islam, but I think these women absolutely represent that. So she is first embraced by these women and then comes to really engage in the ritual of Islam. And that was actually just so wonderful to write, because again, you know, we get back to this very human story, the things that she needs just as a young person. And it's love, it's friendship, it's mentorship that she needs. And that's what these women provide first. And then, I mean, because she, as you know, she doesn't begin wearing the hijab until much later, after she joins that particular religious circle. before their physical mosque is built.
Yeah. We're seeing in, you know, in recent years, the Own Voices movement in literature, increasing recognition of the importance of having people tell their own stories and see their own experiences represented accurately in the stories that they read. Where did you find commonality in literature, you know, when you were starting out as a beginning writer?
Yeah. Well, you know what? And I was so grateful that the American Writers Museum allowed me to contribute a reading list that sort of shaped my identity as an Arab American and then my writing identity. So I would say that for me, it was with Naomi Shihab Nye. So she was one of the first Palestinian American writers who sort of mirrored my sense of being Palestinian in this country. But I would also say, you know, other writers of color, including Chimpa Lahiri, so her short story collection, Interpreter of Omens, to me, that was one of the first major books where I thought, oh, this is a non-white writer who is very much writing about these very universal things, but that are so steeped in Indian culture. I thought maybe there's a space then for me. And Leila Lelemi was another, her short story collection, Hope and Other Dangerous Pursuits. And there have been just amazing writers who, you know, have influenced my own, I suppose, vision of myself and writing truthfully and not in a singular way and not worrying about what people expect, I suppose. And that, though, didn't come immediately. So, you know, I was definitely still writing to the white gaze, I think, earlier in my career. But, you know, now I just feel, you know, sort of fortunate to be surrounded by this wealth of literature. So the hyphenated writer, I think, has, you know, really found, I think, an incredibly larger audience, it feels like. And I'm just grateful for writers who have sort of paved that way for me.
Yeah. Whose work are you reading now that interests you and excites you?
So I actually read a few people at a time, but let me see. I am currently reading a new book by an Iranian American writer, and that's called The Immortals of Tehran. So I've just started that, and I'm excited about getting through that. I'll be in conversation with that writer soon. And I think Leila Lelemi, I'm going to keep coming back to her. So, you know, the other Americans, and I'm excited about this nonfiction collection. Louise Erdrich, too. So she actually has been someone who I've read in just sort of minor experiences. And I just read a novel this past winter that just floored me. And now I think I need to go back and read more of her. I really love Alif Shafak, the Turkish British writer. She's amazing. I think I can go on and on, Allison, but I try to make sure that I do balance between novels and short stories. I felt like I was a short story writer first, and I've definitely been more focused on novel writing. But again, just so many wonderful novels too that are and works that are coming out this year. But I'm definitely revisiting folks who I just had not had a chance to spend a lot of time with.
Yeah. Yeah. You also teach writing and you, mm-hmm. So when you talk to, you know, what are some of the things that you hear, you know, from your students these days about writing? How do they feel about the importance of writing and what are they looking for from you as a teacher?
Yeah. So first of all, I tell them that I'm envious of them because they have technology, which has opened up so many platforms for them to share writing immediately. And I suppose I try to impart that there is an audience that, of course, they need to be writing for themselves first. And that just might be in the form of a blog, maybe a journal. And sometimes it might not be published at all. But I don't ever want them to feel that their voice doesn't matter. And so I've been pretty fortunate because I've had always a mix of students in my creative writing classes who are writers by nature and others who just might have even been dropped into my class because they needed an elective. And realize by the end, oh, I definitely have a lot to say. And I can do it, you know, in any genre and hybrid. And there's someone, you know, who can connect to it and identify. And if not identify, then they're creating these amazing windows, you know, for others to look through. But even in my core classes, I emphasize the importance of writing just to understand themselves, to understand others. And it's such an act of empathy, you know. Fiction writing is for sure, but then even nonfiction creative, you are taking risks, you know, by sharing yourself with the world. And I hope that my young students appreciate how much writing matters, especially, you know, now, especially during times like this too. I've been asking them to document this experience, you know, of social isolation.
Yeah. Well, and so much of their communication, we see this with students who come to the museum as well, where, you know, so much of their communication is written. And so, you know, they're texting, they're emailing, they are, you know, they're writing all of their assignments, and that's how they enter the world and how they understand it. But they don't tend to think of it or honor it as, you know, real writing.
Absolutely.
And so, yeah, they're sort of reticent to do that. So that's really great that you're able to encourage them and validate that.
Absolutely. And I would validate those writings too, you know. So we've done some real cool experimental things. The poet Fadi Judah, he's got a collection that imitates its text language or the Twitter format. It's called TextDo. And so they know that anything that they decide to share with me, to share with others, will be celebrated and honored. So I do appreciate that. Now, of course, there's always the there's always a flip side in terms of formal writing and right. essays and so on, and trying to get them you know, to switch gears, you know, and get back into formal language. But I've had some really great discussions about what does that even mean, you know, formal language, and conversations about elitism, you know, where language is concerned and so on. Yeah. So it's been good. Yeah.
That's great. Well, did you have a passage from the book that you wanted to read for us?
I do. So I'm going to read a section from 1976. This is the first decade that or year that I look at concerning Athaf's life, because we start in the present tense when she is an adult principal of Nuri Din School when the shooter enters the building, and then we are swept back in time. So this is 1976. She doesn't answer her mother the first time she calls her name. Athaf! She keeps jumping on her bed. Athaf, where are you? Majid, her younger brother, is jumping opposite her on a twin bed. He freezes and cranes his head over the tune of Aquarius. The two of them play it relentlessly on a secondhand record player. A garage sale to Athaf's father is yet another novelty of American life. The first time he discovered one down their block, he told her mother, "These Americans sell their own belongings for a profit." In the spring and summer, Athaf and Majid accompany Baba on strolls up and down the alleyways of their neighborhood, searching for open garages. The white owners sitting on lawn chairs, drinking beers and tossing their cigarette butts onto the gravel, haggling with their father. Their wives wear terry cloth shorts and halter tops, stark white tan lines cutting through sunburned skin. Atef can't tear her eyes away from their sagging breasts. On their last trip, Baba purchased a record player from a man with an unkempt beard and glasses like John Lennon, and a desk lamp for $1.50, though Atef's family did not own a desk in their cramped apartment. They do their homework on a chipped coffee table in the front room that her mother wipes down multiple times a day. Mama had turned her nose up at the record player. Masari ala fadi, she scolds, a waste of money. The previous owner had thrown in an odd selection of albums, the Shangri-Las, Pat Boone, and Sam Cooke. Atef and Majid have so far memorized every verse of Hair, her favorite record. Baba listens to Leonard Cohen, improving his English through songs. Suzanne sounds like a bottomless well to Atef. On Sunday mornings, he strums his oud and sings ballads by his favorite Egyptian lute player, Farid al-Atrash. Not as unhappy as Leonard, Baba declares, as though both famous musicians are close friends of his. Atef! The third time Mama calls her name, it's a sure sign of something serious. Atef hops onto the brown shag carpeting and bolts down the narrow hallway of the apartment. Majid sliding behind her in his tube socks across the wooden floor Mama mops every day. Her mother's on the phone, the yellow cord snaking around her fingers. A pot of fava bean stew boils on the stove, and a stack of dishes has been brought down from the cupboard, but Mama hasn't set them yet. Something's disrupted her mother's dinner activity. She's talking in frantic Arabic on the phone. Atef guesses it's Khalti Nisreen on the other end, Mama's youngest sister, the only relative she has in the States, who lives 2 hours away in Kenosha, Wisconsin. Mama turns to Atef with wide hazel eyes, two amber stones with flecks of green or gold, depending on her mood. When she laughs, they are like tiny golden nuggets mined out of the earth. Fear and anger usually turn them green, the color they are now as Mama glares at Atef. Their eyes only her brother Majid has inherited. Eyes Atef covets every day she's surrounded by a sea of white skin and darting blue and green eyes at Nightingale Elementary School. She has Baba's hair thick and wavy. Yes, Mama. Atef stands as close to her mother as she bravely can. Mama scares her in a way she doesn't understand. Her mother is a beautiful woman who takes care of her and her siblings. She cooks every day. Atef and Majid coming home to pots of makhluba and pans of kofta, spices reaching them in the stairwell before they open the back door of the apartment. Before bedtime, she bathes Majid. Atef is allowed to wash herself now and lays out clean clothes for the next day. But there are other days when they come home from school and find Mama in bed, weeping. This lasts for a few days. On those nights, she hears Baba talking to Mama, his soft and consoling words muffled by her mother's sobs. Atef moves carefully around Mama. She's like one of those floppy puppets at the carnival that you knock down with a ball. Atef worries her mother might not get back up again from her bed. Did Netha tell you where she was going after school? Her mother demands, placing her palm over the receiver, though Atef is certain her aunt hears Mama's desperate plea. It hits Atef. Her older sister has not come home yet. She and Majid have been distracted by their singing and jumping, hadn't paid attention to the creeping autumn dusk outside the apartment. Netha is required to be home before the streetlights turn on, before their father comes home from the factory. No, Mama, she didn't say anything to me. They both look at 7-year-old Majid, a futile action. He shakes his head. Why would her 17-year-old sister tell her little brother, or Atef, anything about her mysterious life outside their apartment? Atef is 10 years old, patching together small pieces of her sister, the hours Netha spends smoothing down strands of her thick brown hair, fastening them with tortoiseshell barrettes, or the sly smile that creeps across her face when she reads a letter on torn-out notebook paper, folded and creased many times. The quilt Atef has assembled of her sister isn't a whole person, only glimpses of a double life. And I'll leave it there.
Thank you. That was wonderful. Yeah, it occurred to me listening to it again, just how early you foreshadow a lot of the the aftershocks that, you know, reverberate throughout the book. And so when you were structuring it, were you, you know, did you, this is more of a process question, but did you do that from the beginning and lay it all out ahead of time, or did it sort of grow organically as you wrote?
So focusing on just one character, as I said at the beginning, when I sort of redrafted the very first idea, allowed me to think about Athaf in parts, periods of her life and phases. So what I had to decide was what were those phases going to be? And I had a sense that she'd be a little girl first. And I wanted to make sure that I also went into the formative teenage years. That didn't happen actually in a later draft. So I went back and thought, oh, that's just too important. I needed to definitely have readers see where she is during her teenage years. So definitely by decade, but then within decades, I had to make decisions about real momentous experiences that kept pushing her closer, you know, towards the more significant Islamic transformation.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much for being here with us tonight. And thank you to everyone who's tuned in.
Stay safe, everyone. Thank you so much, Allison.
All right. Take care.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the AWM Author Talks podcast. Next week, our National Poetry Month celebrations continue with Indigenous poets Layli Long Soldier, Mark Turcotte, and Tanaya Winder. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.